The Supreme Court wrapped up its session this week with a substantial volume of decisions. Two of those rulings, one upholding affirmative action programs, the other striking down anti-sodomy laws, were seen as sweeping liberal victories. We thought we'd take this moment to talk about the tilt of the Rehnquist Court in its current configuration and what direction the court may take in the future. Joining us in that conversation are first Jeffrey Rosen, Associate Professor of Law at George Washington University. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And Douglas Kamek, Dean of the Catholic University of America School of Law. Welcome to you.
Nice to be with you.
Let's talk first about these two big decisions this week in the affirmative action and sodomy cases. How do they seem to fit with the pattern of the Rehnquist Court rulings, or don't they? Doug Kamek?
They don't fit. In many ways, they are dramatic, not only doctrinally, but they are dramatic shifts for the court. Let's take affirmative action first. Affirmative action revolves around the issue of where you can use race as a public decision maker. The answer for years of Rehnquist Court precedent was only very rarely to give remedy for prior discrimination. The theory was is that equal protection is a guarantee for black and white, and that it would be inappropriate to use race generally. Justice O'Connor, writing for a majority of the court, decides that race can be used not just for remedy, but also for diversity in an educational setting, and in particular, a highly selective educational setting. That is a significant change. So too in the case dealing with homosexual sodomy. It really disregards in fundamental ways the way in which constitutional adjudication was done in the past by not giving deference to state legislatures to decide basic questions of health, safety, and in this case, morals.
Jeffrey Rosen, there were issues of privacy also in the sodomy case that were ruled upon. What happened there?
The court extended its holding in Roe versus Wade that the Constitution protects a notion of privacy that includes a right to personal dignity and autonomy further than many people thought that it would go. I guess I would say that this is consistent with the Rehnquist Court in this respect. When you think about the largest questions of the culture wars, of which obviously affirmative action and gay rights are the most dramatic, the court has tended to support public opinion rather than to challenge it. And for better or for worse, majorities of the country seem to accept some forms of affirmative action with reservations, as long as they are in the forms of goals and not quotas, and also oppose restrictions on personal intimate expression. They're also consistent in the Rehnquist Court has been quite expansive in its conception of equality. This is an idea that both liberals and conservatives can embrace. And equality was at the center of affirmative action. Each individual has to be treated just like each other. It was central, although not the only holding in the gay rights case. Wrong to discriminate among gays and straights. And we think about the other great questions of the culture wars, religion, abortion, even Bush versus Gore. These were all cases decided on the grounds of equality.
Mm-hmm. These justices have served together now for 9 years, which is a longer period than any other 9-justice high court in U.S. history. Have we seen the tilt of this court shift over time in those 9 years? Is it becoming more liberal, more conservative? Jeffrey Rosen, what do you think?
I would say the consistent theme is judicial supremacy. And sometimes this favors liberal results and sometimes conservative results. The one thing that this court is, unquestionably, is extraordinarily confident of its own abilities and reluctant to defer to the political branches. This court is dismissive of the idea that other branches of government, like Congress or the president, might have the coordinate ability to interpret the Constitution. Basically, they say, the Constitution is what we say it is. Sometimes that favors liberal results, sometimes conservative ones. But the one thing this court is not deferential.
Doug Kamek, has the court shifted over time?
I think the court is still very much dominated by Justices O'Connor and Kennedy. You can see that in this week's opinions. Justice O'Connor writes the majority in the Michigan affirmative action case. Justice Kennedy makes this dramatic ruling about liberty and privacy, which effectively challenges all morals legislation in the sodomy case. Those two justices are very hard to pigeonhole. They are thought to be center-right sometimes, but in fact they can be dramatically to the left, as Justice Kennedy was in this particular opinion, and they have really been shaping the direction of the court. So the court has become less predictably conservative if it ever was to begin with.
At the end of the session, talk always turns to possible resignations, and there were none announced at the end of this term, but there have been two names talked about most frequently as likely to resign. That would be Chief Justice William Rehnquist, who's 78, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who's 73, both of them Republican appointees. What do you think is likely? Do you see a resignation coming up? And if they were to resign, retire, how would that shift the balance of the court, do you think?
Predictions would be the silliest thing imaginable. Here on Friday, half of Washington is waiting breathlessly to see what will happen today or next week. And God and Justice O'Connor only know. But in terms of how the balance would shift, maybe the lesson of the nomination battles to come, whether they come next week or in a year or two from now, is that we shouldn't be too afraid of the court fundamentally uprooting our cultural and social consensus, because the myth of judges as leaders in these issues really isn't supported by the reality of the Rehnquist Court. So much of the alarmism of groups on both sides, which really have an incentive in exaggerating the legal stakes, hasn't been vindicated. The right, in some ways, lost the culture wars and thought that the Supreme Court could hand them victories that they lost in the political arena, but that wasn't vindicated, as we saw this week. And the left, so afraid of Roe versus Wade being overturned, unnecessarily, as we see from this expansive gay rights decision, failed to recognize that they could really fight their abortion battles in the political arena where they'd won as well. So although both sides have an incentive to exaggerate and not to accept their victory, maybe the lesson of this all is that there's going to be a dissonance between the heat generated by the nomination battle when it comes and the actual political and constitutional stakes.
Doug Kamek?
Can we expect a resignation, or a retirement? The original speculation on that began with the premise that, well, this wasn't an election year, so this was an optimum time for people to have that considered. But there's a very large footnote hanging on that now. For the last several months, the Senate of the United States has demonstrated that it can tie itself in knots over lower court nominees. In a totally ahistoric way, they have transplanted the filibuster, which everybody had associated with legislation, to filibustering even lower court judicial nominees. And the Senate's in the midst of trying to work out new rules to see if they can break the logjam on that. So it's not clear any longer that, in fact, there is a window of opportunity that is less contentious than an election year. It seems we're already in the election year, because of the battles being fought on Capitol Hill.
So it may as well happen anytime, you're saying.
Right.
Thanks to you both.
Thanks for having us.
My pleasure.
Douglas Kamek is Dean of the Catholic University of America School of Law. Jeffrey Rosen is Associate Professor of Law at George Washington University.